Ukrainian President Hassan Rouhani says that the U.S. has imposed an all-out economic war against his country, but failed to bring the nation to its knees.
France, Britain, and Germany have dropped a resolution criticizing Iran at this week's meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors.
And talks between the Armenian opposition and Prime Minister Pashinyan over holding his snap parliamentary election fail. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, starting with our top story, President Hassan Rouhani saying that the United States has imposed an all-out economic war against this country.
The international community has witnessed an illegal approach and an all-out economic war imposed by the United States against the Islamic Republic of Iran over the past 4 years. These cruel sanctions have inflicted irreparable damage on the government and people of Iran.
Addressing the 14th summit of the Economic Cooperation Organization, Rouhani said that the U.S. has failed to bring the Iranian nation to its knees. He urged Washington to lift all anti-Tehran sanctions and take practical moves to return to the 2015 nuclear deal. He said that Tehran will reverse its commitment cuts if Washington returns to the agreement. The president also called for a united international front against Washington's unilateral sanctions. That call was echoed by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He urged the U.S. to remove the sanctions and return to the Iran nuclear deal. Erdogan said that the move would contribute to the region's stability and economic prosperity. Now let's now go on with a news review section. Tehran is hailing a decision by the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal to drop an anti-Iran resolution planned for the meeting of the International Atomic Energy Organization. Iran ambassador to the Vienna-based international organizations described the move as a result of extensive diplomatic efforts. Kazem Gharibabadi said that Iran had notified the IAEA's Board of Governors that a resolution would be an obstacle to cooperation between Tehran and the agency. Gharibabadi stressed that the resolution in question lacked technical viability and would have created unnecessary tension. He confirmed that a technical IAEA team will visit Iran in early April, calling it a standard practice in Tehran's dealings with the UN body. The Iran diplomat called on the IAEA to refrain from politicizing the country's nuclear program. Now let's discuss it a little bit and shed some light on it and ask for some insight on that. So joining me will be Mustafa Khoshchesh, political commentator from Tehran. And also we'll have Scott Richer, former UN weapons inspector out of Albany, New York. Good to have both of you gentlemen on the show. Beginning with Mustafa, given the circumstance and the new developments and this fresh agreement signed between the IAEA and Iran, do you foresee a smooth cooperation like it's always been between the two sides?
Hello, Behrouz, and thanks for having me. Well, by two sides, you mean the IAEA, right?
Right. And Iran.
Right. Yeah. Iran has been under largest number of man hours of inspections before the JCPOA. And ever since the nuclear deal was struck, Iran has been under the harshest regime of inspections ever imposed on any nation. It's been cooperating with the IAEA even beyond the additional protocol to the NPT, which was put to a halt very recently by Iran after the U.S. defied its nuclear deal undertakings, even after Biden took office. But Tehran and IAEA cooperation continue as usual under the NPT. Iran is also complying with the safeguard agreement, inspections done under the safeguard agreement. But the point here is that this was an excessive demand by the West, by the Europeans, that after Biden came to office, they have started the same old game of raising excessive demands and using IAEA as an instrument for political means in order to push Tehran to give more and more concessions That's a worn-out game to Iran, and Iran's threats to cut off cooperation that was vowed a few days ago under the new cooperation or statement jointly issued by Iran and the IAEA for the next 3 months before Iran makes the final move and ends the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol. This resolution that was sponsored or being sponsored by the EU3 as well as the US could kill that newly endorsed statement, and also it could kill the JCPOA altogether. Although, yet I do not see much of a chance for the United States to remove the sanctions in compliance with the JCPOA undertakings, I do believe that the United States has long been after containing Iran through this containment strategy that relies very much on threats, military threats and sanctions. And after last year, after the triple incidents in the Persian Gulf, the last one being Iranian missile strike on Ain al-Assad, the United States military threat has proved to be incredible, not credible anymore, and Iran may not change its decision under the military threats, and it was proved after Ain al-Assad. So the U.S. strategy of containment relies very much now on the sanctions regime against Iran. And what they want is not just Iran's nuclear program or missile program or anything. They want to contain Iran's power in all areas. Therefore, Biden is not speaking of removing the sanctions. Following the U.S. exit from the nuclear deal under Donald Trump's administration, they started the FSW or fortifying sanctions wall. They copy-pasted the nuclear-related sanctions under different labels like terrorism, missile industry, and so on and so forth. That's in a total breach of JCPOA paragraphs 25 and 26 that bans any such move and copy-pasting the nuclear-related sanctions under different labels. But they've been doing so in order to take more and more concessions from Iran in various areas. Okay. Ever since Biden started his presidential campaign, he and his people have never spoken of anything beyond the nuclear-related sanctions. So for sure, they do not mean to remove the sanctions. And if this happens, then Iran would put an end to JCPOA. So I believe still we have less than three more months to go ahead and see if Biden would take and would make the a wise decision eventually or not.
Yeah, we're gonna wait and see. Now let me turn to Scott Ritter. Scott, how do you look at things unfolding? This has been a positive step as Tehran is hailing it on part of the IAEA. Now, it has been under pressure, the agency has been under pressure. You know who I'm talking about. Do you think that it can maintain its independent work and go on as it should on a standard basis? And how will that affect this Iran nuclear deal?
Well, first of all, it's very possible for the agency to behave independently and professionally. They have done so in the past. They are doing so now, and they will do so in the future if permitted. The IAEA is an implementation body. It's not a policymaking body. Mm-hmm. And it's prisoner to those who make policy. It's prisoners to its board of governors. And that board of governors is highly susceptible to outside influence, as we just recently saw, where the United States lobbied three European members to push forward a resolution that, if implemented, could have killed not only the JCPOA, but all cooperation between the IAEA and Iran. One of the dangers of this resolution isn't so much the resolution in and of itself, but that it repeats a pattern of behavior that dates, has a precedent in 2005, 2006, where the United States used similar governor resolutions to create the conditions that allowed the Iranian file to be transferred to the Security Council and then have sanctions imposed. So by defeating this, by having this resolution withdrawn, the door for a diplomatic resolution remains open. I agree with your previous commentator. It's It's not a guarantee that either party is going to be able to successfully go through that door, but the door still remains open, and that's hopeful.
Okay, thank you very much for your contribution. We had Mustafa Khoshesh, political commentator from Tehran, and Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector, who joined us from Albany, New York, with our contribution. And that's it for this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. Let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. The fiancé of assassinated Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi has urged a Turkish court to consider a recent CIA report as evidence and hold the Saudi crown prince responsible for the murder.
We filed a request. We will follow up the process with the lawyers. The report that was published puts responsibility directly on the crown prince. In this regard, I request that this is included in the court process here.
Hatice Cengiz made a request after a trial session of Khashoggi's killing in Istanbul. It was held in absentia of 20 Saudi suspects, including two former aides to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Last week, the United States declassified an intelligence report that publicly accused bin Salman of approving Khashoggi's murder in the kingdom's Istanbul consulate in 2018. Despite a revelation, Washington stopped short of applying sanctions on the MBS. Israel is condemning a decision by the International Criminal Court to formally investigate the regime's war crimes in the Palestinian territories. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the decision outrageous and vowed to fight the Hague-based tribunal. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda has pledged an impartial and objective inquiry without any fear or favor. The court ruled that it has jurisdiction to investigate crimes committed in the occupied West Bank, including Jerusalem al-Quds and the Gaza Strip. The ICC is set to look into Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, its settlement activities, and the regime's deadly response to anti-occupation protest rallies held in 2018. The Palestinians welcomed the decision as a long-awaited step that serves their tireless pursuit of justice. Now, talks between Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan and the opposition on holding a snap election have failed, and that after Pashinyan expressed willingness to hold early parliamentary elections, provided that the opposition agreed to certain conditions. He also proposed holding a referendum in October on adopting a new constitution, but the parliamentary opposition faction has refused the conditions so far. Pashinyan has faced a political crisis since the army's call for his resignation last week. The embattled prime minister has rejected the call, saying it amounted to a coup attempt. Pashinyan is under fire for his handling of the conflict with Azerbaijan over Nagorno-Karabakh, which resulted in ethnic Armenians losing swathes of territory. The United Nations top human rights official says that Myanmar's ruling junta must halt its vicious crackdown on peaceful protesters. Michelle Bachelet says the military must stop murdering and jailing protesters. She expressed grave concerns over the use of live ammunition against peaceful ralliers. UN Rights Office says at least 54 people have been killed by police since early February, the majority of the deaths taking place during the Wednesday protests. Some 1,700 people have also been arrested since the February military coup d'etat. Daily anti-coup demonstrations have taken place ever since. Protesters demand the return of civilian rule and the release of detained officials, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi.
The recent coup in Myanmar has taken the time back to 1962, when the military took control of the Southeast Asian country 14 years after its independence from Britain. Since then, the stage was set for military's power play until 2011. When Myanmar underwent democratic reforms and began parliamentary elections. The military junta seized power on February 1 and declared a one-year-long state of emergency after detaining the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and members of her National League for Democracy Party, among other elected government officials. The military claimed that the November election, in which Suu Kyi's party won with a landslide, was rigged. However, the Election Commission nullified this claim, stating that there was no evidence. While the ousted leader is under house arrest, military commander-in-chief Ming Aung Hlaing has taken power. Despite public opposition, he attempted to justify the takeover by saying the military is on the people's side and would form a true and disciplined democracy. That is while the military junta says it wants to hold a free and fair election once the state of emergency is over. However, the country has lapsed into chaos since February 1 coup, sparking daily mass protests as well as global condemnation. The U.S. and the European Union are weighing up imposing sanctions against the junta leaders. The U.S. already has imposed some sanctions against some of the major junta leaders. Nonetheless, the military has ignored the international outcry and responded to the public opposition with escalating force. So far, 50 people have been killed and hundreds arrested during the military junta's lethal crackdown on nationwide anti-coup protests. Wednesday marked Myanmar's bloodiest day since the military takeover. The UN Special Envoy on Myanmar confirmed that 38 people lost their lives after security forces opened fire on protesters demanding the return of civilian rule in the country.
Well, I guess nobody knows why, but my speculation is that they are the ones who hold on to the power at this moment, and they are very motivated by having the power, whether economically or running the country. So now, because they are taking over the country by force, and nobody wants to have the military run the country, and therefore people are standing up for their rights, and that is exactly what the dictators, the Burmese government, junta, doesn't want it.
Now, Myanmar has been criticized for its deadly military crackdown on Rohingya Muslims in 2017, which led to the killing of at least 6,700 people and forced hundreds of thousands to flee across the border in Myanmar. Since then, the West's interest in Myanmar has faded, and with the recent coup d'etat, the trend of Western withdrawal has probably accelerated. The U.S. has already imposed sanctions on the junta leaders, with the EU also considering sanctions. Now, the recent U.S. sanctions against junta leaders will push Myanmar further into Beijing's corner. Beijing is one of Myanmar's biggest trade partners, so with the U.S. and the West sanctioning Myanmar, China will benefit economically from the U.S. and West's sanctions. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
When the verdict came, it reduced the Paris court to a stunned silence. Nicolas Sarkozy was guilty of corruption and influence peddling and sentenced to 3 years in prison, two of them suspended. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Kim Wilshire. The piece is titled Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy sentenced to jail for corruption. Stay with us for more of Kim Wilshire's article. When the verdict came, it reduced the Paris courtroom to a stunned silence. Nicolas Sarkozy was guilty of corruption and influence peddling and sentenced to 3 years in prison, two of them suspended. France's president from 2007 to 2012 had played an active role in forging a corruption pact with his lawyer and a senior magistrate to obtain information on a separate investigation into political donations, the leading judge declared, and there was serious and concurring evidence of collaboration between the three men to break the law. The conviction and sentence were dramatic, unexpected, and historic. Nicolas Sarkozy, 66 years old, had repeatedly declared his innocence and dismissed the charges as an insult to my intelligence. It is, however, unlikely he will spend a day in jail. His lawyer has announced he intends to appeal the decision, a process that could lead to a new trial and a one-year prison sentence can be served outside of jail under certain conditions, including the wearing of an electronic bracelet or limited home confinement. Sarkozy did not comment as he left the courtroom, but his wife, the supermodel turned singer Carla Bruni, on Instagram described the verdict as an injustice. Quel acharnement insensé, mon amour. Le combat continue, la vérité fera jour, which translates as, what relentless nonsense, my love. The battle continues, the truth will out. And that was from Carla Bruni's official Instagram account. While Sarkozy was not banned from holding public office, the verdict delivered on Monday afternoon, 1st of March 2021, is likely to quash his hopes of returning to public life in time for next year's presidential elections in France. His centre-right, Le Républicain Party, LR Party, has been struggling to come up with a credible candidate since Sarkozy's former Prime Minister, François Fillon, was engulfed in scandal during the 2017 presidential race, opening the way for the current president, Emmanuel Macron, to win. Trial last year, the court heard how Nicolas Sarkozy instructed his lawyer, Thierry Herzog, to offer the senior magistrate, Gilbert Azibert, a cushy job in the Côte d'Azur in return for information on an investigation into whether he had received donations from the ailing L'Oréal heiress, Liliane Bettencourt. The Bettencourt case was eventually dropped, but by then, an investigation into corruption and influence peddling had been opened. The judge, Christine May, the president of the tribunal, said there was serious evidence of a corruption pact between Nicolas Sarkozy, Thierry Herzog, and Gilbert Azibert. Herzog, age 65, and Azibert, 73, were given similar sentences of 3 years imprisonment, two of them suspended. The case, based on telephone taps, became known as the Bismuth Affair. Paul Bismuth was the name the former president Nicolas Sarkozy employed in connection to two burner telephones used to communicate with Thierry Herzog. French detectives began monitoring Sarkozy's communications in September of 2013 as part of an investigation into claims he had received an illegal and undeclared 50 million euro donation from the former Libyan strongman and dictator Muammar Gaddafi to fund his successful 2007 presidential campaign. What they heard, though, from the recorded conversations pointed investigators in a new and unexpected direction. They revealed the former president, Sarkozy, and his lawyer, Thierry Herzog, were secretly communicating using mobile telephones registered under false names. Additional wiretaps on these phones picked up conversations suggesting Sarkozy had been in contact with Gilbert Azibert, then a member of the Cour de Cassation, the highest court in France, via Thierry Herzog to request confidential information about the Lilian Betancourt case. Nicolas Sarkozy, who is embroiled in several legal cases, has repeatedly denied accusations of any wrongdoing in all past and present investigations. He spent years attempting to have the bismuth charges thrown out and the case dismissed. Thierry Herzog argued the secretly recorded conversations between him and former President Sarkozy were covered by client-lawyer privilege and could not be used as evidence. Before his trial last year, Nicolas Sarkozy had said he welcomed the hearing as a chance to clean my name. I am combative. I have no intention of being accused of things I haven't done. I'm not corrupt, and what has been inflicted on me is a scandal that will rest in the annals. The truth will out, Nicolas Sarkozy told BMF TV. The former French president is expected to appear in court later this month in yet another case, the Big Malian affair, in which he's accused of overspending on his 2012 re-election bid. Nicolas Sarkozy is also being investigated on allegations of influence peddling and laundering of crime and misdemeanor related to consulting activities in Russia. Sarkozy's supporters have accused French judges of making the former president the target of an unfair and relentless legal crusade. He's the first former president to appear in court on criminal charges. His predecessor, Jacques Chirac, was charged and convicted, received a 2-year suspended sentence over fake jobs at City Hall when he was the mayor of Paris, but was spared taking the stand in the courtroom because of ill health. At the end of his 2-week trial last year, Sarkozy said, "This case has been for me the stations of the cross, but if that was the price to pay for the truth to come out, I'm ready to accept it. I still have confidence in the justice of our country." His lawyer, Thierry Herzog, was also convicted of breaching the rules of professional secrecy between him and his client. Thierry Herzog and Gilbert Azibert have announced they will appeal the court's decision and they will appeal against their conviction. After the verdict, Damien Abad, the president of Les Républicains, or LR parliamentary group, tweeted, "Today I want to again express my friendship with President Nicolas Sarkozy. His life has been a succession of trials that he has never ceased to overcome with energy and courage. Once again, he will prove this. I'm certain of it."
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing The House on Cocoa Road, directed by Damani Baker. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Telegraph, The Guardian, and many others. And alongside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, The House on Cocoa Road is the story of director Damani Baker's family, particularly about his mother's story, Fanny Houghton, who moved her children from Oakland, California, to participate in the Grenada Revolution, only to find her family in harm's way of a US military invasion. This film also sheds light on the history of black power movements and their struggle for racial equality.
This country has a painful legacy of violence that we still struggle to confront.
I think we always have to find something that holds a promise, and that way we look toward the future.
You're committed to humanity, to making the world a better place. You know, not just for your family, but everybody's family. We were trying to make sense of this world.
One of the most important things that has to be done in the process of carrying out a revolutionary struggle is to merge the personal with the political, where they're no longer separate.
You have a situation where we are trying to build a new society.
Grenada is the southernmost of the Windward Islands in the West Indies.
Here's our revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
It was a utopia.
And the next thing I knew, she was packing you all up.
Grenada, we were told, was a friendly island paradise for tourism. Well, it wasn't. It was a Soviet Cuban colony being readied as a major military bastion to export terror and undermine democracy.
I took my young children out of my country to come here to help this country. I left in pain. This is the first time I've been back, so you've got to be very sensitive.
I remember you asking me, as the bombs dropped and the island shook, you said, this must be what they call war.
There is a freedom tide rising in our hemisphere. The spirit of democracy is assuming its rightful role as the great unifier of the people.
They're shooting! They're shooting!
My mother always said that this is not the way things are supposed to be. And if we work towards change, conditions will become different.
Long live peace in our Americas and in the world. Forward ever, backward never.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for joining the show. Now, this documentary gives you an insightful and historical look at race relations in the U.S. and also offers an alternative look at the U.S.-led invasion of Grenada, but from a black perspective. And Mike, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on this film?
I think it's a very strong film. It's a very engaging film. I think what it does particularly well, there's a clip very early on where Angela Davis, the great black activist, is saying, we need to make the personal political. And this is exactly what this film does. It starts with this opening montage of footage from various tapes that Damani Baker, the director, has found in, I think, the garage of his mother when he was moving her house. She was moving house. Yeah, and you know, so you've got footage from, you know, 83, 99, 2015, all spliced together. And you get a sense of a young man, young filmmaker, piecing these disparate frames and images together, trying to work out what they represent. But it does so in a way that's incredibly casual. It doesn't feel like a serious history lesson. It feels like you've been invited over to someone's house on a Sunday morning. They're telling you about their family history over coffee and cake. It's sort of deceptively casual, but it does build to a much bigger picture of American life, and black American life in particular.
And Lee, if I could turn to you now, why is it important to revisit these topics? And we see like a tour of sort of documentaries coming out about black power movements, and we've covered quite a few on this show with the Black Panther Party and so forth. What relevance does it have today?
Yeah, it's great relevance, and I think when you look at the historical film that we have, particularly with films like this, it's surprising how much contemporary resonance it has with the situation of African-American communities today in America. But it also speaks, I think, that film to a broader narrative. And it's this perpetual search within the African diaspora for that home, that place, that belonging. And wherever it is, from wherever our particular roots are, we have a deep need to be reconnected. And I think that what you're looking at is African Americans seeking to escape the predations of Jim Crow, you know, racism and its legacies in America, going to Grenada, and then finding themselves at the end of an imperialist gun. And I thought that was a powerful narrative. You sought to escape racism, but actually you've ended up in a place where American imperialism has rolled up on the Grenadian shores with devastating consequences. And I also think the narrative about black women's leadership role in having to make decisions about their family, where they live, what quality of life they will like. Those are the kind of conversations that I think are, you know, very deep within black communities of, can we survive here? Will we prosper here? Will our children be treated equally?
That is a very important point to make, and this documentary certainly raises all those issues. It's also a very political film, as you alluded to also. I just want to talk a little bit now about the politics of the film before we move on. So on the one hand, Mike, the official US narrative of the invasion of Grenada was that Grenada's government was working with so-called communist Cuba and wanted to make a base there. And Ronald Reagan, the president at the time, quote, said it was necessary to bring the spirit of freedom and to Grenada in the form of a military strike. But of course, this documentary goes against this narrative, doesn't it, and offers a different perspective.
It does. I think it what it succeeds in doing is presenting this counter. Because Damani Baker realizes that when the family moves away from Grenada, goes back to the USA, the image that he sees of Grenada in American media is very different from the image that he saw growing up. And, you know, you're getting the sense that American news media presented Ronald Reagan as this great liberator. He went into Grenada and sorted the situation out, and all of a sudden it's much better for him doing that. And actually, Damani Baker, what he's done by making this film and piecing all these individual pieces of footage together that have been taken over the decades, what he's done is he's actually presented a very convincing counter-image to that claim, and the counter-image to what was the dominant image in American media at the time.
Mm. And I did a bit of more research actually on this topic because I found it really interesting in the way this documentary brought it up. And it was reported that a senior British officer who watched the Grenada invasion from Barbados, Major Mark Adkin, he wrote afterwards, quote, that it was launched because of the intense desire of the president and his advisors to raise US prestige, particularly at home and in the armed forces, where morale and self-respect had fallen substantially since the Vietnam War. Lee, do you think that this was the real reason then behind the invasion?
Well, yeah, there's nothing like crushing a little country to, reinforce one's flagging self-esteem. So that's a narrative we've seen in world politics. But I also think that the you've got to remember that, you know, with Norman Manley in Jamaica at the time, that there was a very much sense that there might be a domino effect in relation to socialism, communism in the region.
The US perceived this as a threat?
The US perceived this as a very real threat that could see a swathe of Caribbean islands really moving to the left. Not far from their coast. And so a combination of hubris, arrogance, imperialism, and real genuine fear, I think, of the extent to which the Caribbean could be involved, fueled American ambition to try and stamp out any nascent light of an alternative socialist agenda in the region.
Hello, my name is Damani Baker. I am the director of The House on Cocoa Road, a documentary about my mother. My mom moved my sister and I from Oakland, California, where I was born and raised, to take part in the Grenada Revolution. So this film was about how we ended up in Grenada in the first place, how we ended up in a country that eventually would be invaded by the United States as my family hid under a bed when bombs dropped all around us. In order to understand that, I had to go back and retrace my mother's history, her story. Her story of having parents who were part of the Great Migration West, great-grandparents who were sharecroppers in the South, how she served children in the Black Panther Party's pre-breakfast program, and eventually became Angela Davis' teaching assistant at UCLA in the 60s. So this is a film about women leaders, it's about my mother, and it's about people who really imagined a better way to live.
So that was Damani Baker there himself speaking about the purpose of this film. And I think what's special about this documentary, and also quite unique, is that it offers, as well as being a political film, it offers an intimate look at Damani's personal life. What do you make of this sort of aspect of the film? Was it important?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it sort of falls into that kind of who do you think you are, that kind of the TV series where people look back into their roots. So it starts out as Damani Baker looking back and trying to figure out how on earth his family got here from there. So, you know, his great-grandmother was part of a sharecropping family in the American South, and there was Great Migration, then civil rights, you know, the advances in civil rights. And he's trying to piece out where he falls in it. How come that he, as a young filmmaker, you know, has the time, and the leisure time, and the money to go around the world making movies, and you know,
even the title of the film, The House on Cocoa Road, has a personal touch, doesn't it?
Yes, it's trying to sort of pin down places in the past and to sort of plot, if you like, a sort of straight line. You know, how do we get here now in this moment, given everything that's gone before us, and given the indifference of white America to our family and our struggles? You know, how do we get through all that to get to where we are today? And you know, the archive footage is very important in sort of nailing down exactly where that family was at those particular times.
I suppose this is a very symbolic message then, Lee, that politics is kind of inseparable to black African Americans and their life and their struggle to the present day.
Absolutely, deeply intertwined, and we very much live our lives vicariously through those politics. But I think it's also an interesting narrative on the phenomenon of migration in the modern world, and how those migratory tales can be best be told by the sort of intimate portrait of an individual or group of individuals who are seeking to make a better life for themselves and often escape, you know, horrendous and circumstances. So I think it speaks to that broader narrative. And within that, there's the African diaspora, which scattered across the four ends of the earth, is in a perpetual search for its own identity, its own place in the world, and very much the stepping stones from Africa to the West are seen as important steps along that story.
And that reminds me actually of what you were saying of the main protagonist in this documentary, Damani Baker's mother.
Yeah.
What did you make of her contribution, Mike?
It's very important that actually the bulk of the voices that you hear in this documentary are female. So it's Fanny, it's her friends and her neighbours in Grenada. It's about women trying to make a life for themselves and trying to raise a family. And it's also, the film itself is the work of a son trying to pay tribute to a mother who raised him right. And I think that's why it's so emotional and so affecting at the end of the day.
I'd like to ask Sister Angela to make a few brief introductory remarks.
I'm here in pre-Grenada for the very first time. The experiences that I've had here in Grenada have confirmed in a very powerful way where we are headed, what the future of the entire planet ought to look like. This beautiful, powerful, militant revolution.
My sister Fania and I were so excited by what we saw. We were so struck by the enthusiasm of the not only the leaders, but the everyday people. For us, Grenada, especially for black people, really marked a new moment in history.
It just sort of captured the imagination of us. Here's a socialist government. A revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
This is legendary activist Angela Davis, world-renowned scholar and activist and was a member of the Black Panther Party. Now, Lee, in the film, Grenada was described by black people as being a sort of utopia for black people. And Maurice Bishop, the prime minister at the time, who was tragically later shot dead, said, if we have 95% of predominantly African origin in our country, then we can have a dangerous appeal to 30 million black people in the United States. So why was there such a longing from African Americans for sort of a strong black community and leadership?
I think very much African Americans had, coming out of the Vietnam War, were beginning to reassess their place in society. They'd taken part in the Olympics, they'd fought in world wars, and yet they were still facing the horrendous police brutality and economic discrimination in the land of the home of the free and the land of the brave. And I think they began to fundamentally reassess, or at least some did, reassess the extent to which they could prosper in such societies. And as all African diasporas do, they look to elsewhere in the world where their fortunes might be greater. And of course, there's a deep longing and sort of Garveyan sense of the Jamaican leader Marcus Garvey to build Black Nation, to build an example of how humanity can work together in a progressive way. And very much the ideals of Cuba and the Grenada revolutionary movement encapsulated for very many Black diasporans, African diasporans, their desire to see Black nationhood, to see progressive socialism encapsulated and led by, you know, not just Cuba, but joined in by other islands in and around the Caribbean. And as such, it elevated itself into a international country of appeal, where the revolutionary movement put out a worldwide appeal for Africans in the diaspora to come help rebuild Grenada and be part of that movement. And lots of people from the United Kingdom, from the United States, other parts of the world, responded to that call.
That's very revealing indeed. I think many people know about this aspect of Grenada from the Black perspective.
Yeah.
And just speaking of that, Mike, I think also what's invaluable of Baker's documentaries, this archive material he has that juxtaposes sort of the propaganda and he touches on the role of the media. Mm-hmm. What is life like? What was life? How was life painted for Black people in Grenada? The reality of it.
Well, I mean, this is one of the important facets of this particular film. You get a sense of a place that is trying to, I think the phrase that Maurice Bishop uses, to throw off the Coca-Cola mentality and you know, go in a different direction. And so you do get the footage that we get here that was taken by Damani Baker's own family is very much from the ground up. You're seeing, you know, a kind of grassroots movement building. You know, you're seeing people, you know, taking control of their own destinies in a way that clearly threatened the Reagan administration. And you get this sort of strange sort of contrast between Angela Davis and that particular way of thinking and the Ronald Reagan way of thinking, which, you know, is a little, shall we say, slightly more fearful. Yes.
Resonates a lot with today, of course.
I think so. And, you know, those contrasts, yes, do have a resonance in what's going on in America today with the way certain white leaders are espousing their values.
We're not naming any names.
Not naming any names, no.
Well, we'll have to move swiftly on just for now.
Do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
All of a sudden, the drugs came in so heavy, it was scary, but it destroyed the entire city of Oakland. I mean, there's a discussion now where that came from. Entire Black communities were destroyed. With all of my efforts to put you in a good school and try to balance it, there was still, we could sit on that hill in East Oakland and hear gunfire all down the hill all night.
It was very disappointing to see all the work that we've done being overrun by drugs. It was not a happy time in the Black community anywhere in the States.
That was not an environment to raise children. Bit more of Angela Davis then. We talked a little bit about her, but I'd like to talk about her a little bit more just before we end the show. And Mike, what do you make of her contribution to this documentary?
It's very important. I mean, she turns up very early on in the film because Fanny Damani Baker's mother was a student of hers at the UCLA, yes, and later became her assistant. So it's almost about the role of mentoring in American life and how having a good mentor can, you know, change the way you think about the world, change the way you perceive the world. And I think Angela Davis becomes almost Fanny's mentor, you know, and takes her to protests and leads her into a more engaged way of thinking about the world.
And the documentary sheds light on her fair share of struggle, Angela Davis, in her life for racial equality. What does she mean for Black activists everywhere?
Hugely symbolic figure for Black activists worldwide, continues to be an inspiration today for the the millennials who you see in the Black Lives Matter movement and wider. African women on the continent, still with her Angela Davis. She's held in extraordinarily high regard right across the world. And quite rightly so, when you think about the radical stance that she took, putting herself in danger, risking jail, risking the loss of her life, all for the principled struggle for justice and equality. Angela Davis, you know, remains a very sort of bright, burning firmament on the skyline. And she will be revered, I think, for a long time to come.
And what I found inspiring, actually, from this documentary was watching her leadership and how the black unions at the time in the 80s organized. Do you think movements today can learn a lot about that era?
Well, we look at the post-Weinstein movement and the Me Too movement, and we realize just how far we've got to come. People have to realize when Angela Davis was doing what she was doing, we were talking about 1970s, late 60s America, where the kind of super black machismo was still very much of the sort of shaft. You know, militant young black man was still the focus of the struggle. And on comes Angela Davis, and in one stroke, recenters that struggle, putting black women at the heart of that movement. It was revolutionary at the time, and when you look back on it, you have to appreciate just how significant it really was.
And Michael, we're running towards the end of the show now. I just wanted to get your final thoughts on this film, and would you recommend it?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I found it, you know, inspirational. I found it very engaging. I also found it very educational. I mean, I've not seen much treatment, cinematic treatment, of the events in Grenada. So to have a, you know, a first-hand perspective, to have people who are actually on the ground at the time telling the story in their own words, in this very laid-back, you know, very informal way, it was an education for me.
And Lee, if I could turn to you, your final thoughts, and would you recommend this film?
Definitely recommend the film. I think that anything that captures that sort of historical narrative from the victim perspective is going to offer really unique insights for people, and also for people to get a real appreciation of how important globally the Grenadian Revolution was to Africans right across the world.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayaki.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.